Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight I'm joined by Bay Area author Si Peng Zhang to discuss her debut novel, How Much of These Hills is Gold, a powerful story of two Chinese-American siblings who navigate the hills of California alone during the Gold Rush era. Pam's novel challenges the historically white male narrative of the American West and also grapples with questions of identity, family, belonging, and power. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Chris Verdugo, executive director of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, on how the organization is creatively adapting to our new normal. And we'll end the program with the chorus's Truly Brave, a virtual tribute to healthcare workers and first responders on the front lines of this pandemic. But first, as always, the latest in Bay Area coronavirus news. I'm pleased to be joined again by Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at UCSF. Welcome back to City Visions, Aaron and Peter.
Always a pleasure.
Yes.
Pache and Aaron. Can we all talk together?
Yes, we can. Aaron, I wanted to start with you. You reported yesterday that cases in the Bay Area are increasing. About 1,500 new cases were reported in the Bay Area last week, an increase of almost 40%. Particularly struck is Alameda County, which has now surpassed Santa Clara County as the most hard-hit region in the Bay Area. What factors are thought to contribute to these increases in cases?
Well, the short, unsatisfactory answer is that we don't really know exactly. There's, you know, as always with this this pandemic, a lot of uncertainty, and we can kind of speculate, but we may not have the actual answers for a little while. That said, you know, the counties, as they reopened and as they ramped up testing, have said that they anticipated that they would see increases in cases, and most of them think that's exactly what's happening right now. So, you know, as you test more people, you would expect to find more cases, and that's what we're seeing, and that's probably what is at least part of the reason for Alameda County jumping up. Alameda County in particular was a little bit behind the other counties on testing, so maybe had some catching up to do. Again, we don't really know that for sure, but that is certainly a possibility as to why Alameda County has jumped ahead. And then the other aspect again is this reopening process. All of these counties 2 weeks ago allowed construction to resume and some other outdoor activities. So the thinking is that, you know, we're seeing some of those folks kind of go back to work and maybe being exposed and getting sick that way. And the other thinking is just that as we go through this sort of opening process, people are getting a little bit looser and a little bit, you know, sloppier even with their own social distancing habits, maybe not, you know, being quite as obedient as they were before. And we may just be seeing some of that going on. And that's just, you know, it's an adjustment period for all of us. And that may be what we're seeing here now.
Peter, what's your take on this increase in numbers? And are these new cases resulting in a spike in hospitalizations or deaths?
Well, Joseph, I think that at the hospital level, we haven't really seen a decline in serious cases. It's more of a plateau. So while I think we feel excited that the community is seeing general stability of cases, except for Alameda, as you pointed out, showing a slight increase for unclear reasons. On the hospital front, you know, whether or not we're getting a lot of transfers, but we're still seeing quite a number of patients in the ICU, you know, in the 14 to 20 range at one hospital, you know, thinking that, you know, overall we're seeing about 40 to 50 patients.
So how optimistic are you with the United States passing the milestone of over 100,000 deaths this day, and not this day, but I mean today, and with over 100,000 cases in California, about 3,800 of those cases led to deaths. Optimistic, cautious, where are you today?
I guess I can say something first, and then it'll be great to get Aaron's comments as well. But I would say that I'm nervous, I'm worried, but I do understand that we can't be cloistered forever on the other hand. And I'm hopeful that with, at least in the Bay Area, certainly with the contact tracing workforce that we have and the ramping up in testing, that we will be able to know if we're seeing an uptick in the community overall and then maybe scale back a little bit.
Aaron. Yeah, I'm with Peter. You know, I think there certainly is reason to be, you know, to be optimistic in the Bay Area that, you know, we have health officers here who are very, very conservative, being very kind of gradual about this reopening, more so than, I mean, arguably anywhere in the country at this point. And I think that that's good. That feels sort of like we'll be in a good, they're not going to do anything rash. They're going to kind of keep us in check and keep things, I think, from spiraling. What concerns me is even with all of, you know, their aggressive efforts, we're still seeing, you know, these increasing case counts. We're still seeing these surges that happen even when, you know, we have very gradual reopening. We see these surges coming up. And I think it just is this reminder that we're going to be dealing with this thing potentially for a very, very long time. And, you know, I can't help but think out, you know, what's going to happen when kids go back to school, because they need to go back to school at some point, and what's going to happen in the flu season. And, you know, there are these sort of kind of moments and events looking forward that just sort of niggle at the back of your mind that even if things are okay, if we come out of this at some point in the next couple of months and get to do some sort of normal, that, you know, we're in this for such a long, long haul that it can get a little exhausting to think about. So I can't help but kind of go there sometimes.
Right. And in this push-pull, so to speak, as one author puts it, between lives and livelihoods, Governor Newsom loosened restrictions on churches, allowing services to resume, although there were some parameters in place. And there's also retail, in-store retail is reopening, not in the Bay Area, but in a lot of counties within California. And barbershops are also planning to reopen in large parts of California, but not specifically in the Bay Area. Tell us about the calculus that the governor went through in deciding to give in on the concerns of the clergy.
I don't know that we have a lot of information on exactly how the governor is coming to these conclusions. What, you know, we don't know much about the models that he's looking at, and, you know, what sort of his advisors are whispering in his ears. I will say that, you know, from the folks I've talked to, the experts I've talked to, what's going on is, I mean, he's obviously been getting a lot of political pushback from the counties that that were, you know, feeling like these were too restrictive, that they hadn't seen many cases, and that this was, you know, this really was crushing their economy for not a lot of good reason in their specific cases. And the truth is that it's a tough spot. You know, California is this big patchwork. We have a lot, you know, a wide variety of situations happening from county to county. And I think what we're seeing is the governor essentially deciding to put these decisions, these tough decisions about how to safely reopen, in the hands of local health officers, for better or worse. So that means that, you know, these health officers presumably are now in a position to make the best choices for their communities. And that's, you know, that's kind of how our system is set up. You know, the problem is that these health officers, then that leaves them vulnerable to these similar kind of political push pulls. You know, they have boards of supervisors, they have politicians saying we want to reopen. So I think that some of that is now kind of happening in the state. You know, interestingly enough, Sonoma County just today decided not to move forward with some reopening that they had on the table. They had planned to do in-store retail this week and a few other things, and their health officer spoke up and said, no, you know, we're seeing the spike in cases. I'm seeing some troubling things. I don't like the direction we're going. We need to take a little pause. And so they're doing that now. So I think we're going to see a lot of that kind of activity happening, hopefully, as health officers keep an eye on things.
Perhaps it's easier to put pressure on a governor than it is on a health officer. Who knows? But I can understand why that pressure is mounting. The New York Times reported that California is estimated to have an unemployment rate above 20%, way above the national average, which hovers just below 15%. Why do you think we've taken such a hit here in comparison to other states?
Well, I mean, we did the early shelter in place. So, I mean, I think that we were really aggressive, much more so than any other state, really, in terms of kind of shutting things down really early in this. And that, you know, certainly saved lives. It, you know, even in Los Angeles, which has seen a lot of cases, we haven't had overwhelmed hospitals. You know, we've been in a pretty good situation as far as this pandemic compared to other hard hit areas. So, you know, you can certainly make a solid argument that that was the right thing to do, but certainly we're paying the price for that on the jobs front and the economy front. And I think, you know, the truth is our economy is also very reliant on travel and tourism and, you know, certain industries that aren't, they're going to be very easy to kind of take hits early on, and they're going to be hard to recover. And I think that that's another thing that we're looking at right now.
And San Francisco announced today the so-called Right to Recover, a new program to give eligible workers with COVID-19 2 weeks of wages. What do we know about this program, and who would qualify for it?
So I believe that that's, I guess I shouldn't speak. I don't know the exact details about who would qualify. I know it's meant to kind of cover folks who might not be covered by other programs. So, you know, you don't need to prove citizenship or, you know, any sort of status like that. So as far as I believe it's open to pretty much anybody. There may be kind of income requirements. So I probably shouldn't say that for certain. But the idea, of course, of this program is you need people, if they test positive, to be able to not go to work and not be worried about that loss of wages. Because if people are worried about that, then A, they're just going to go to work when they're sick if they have to support their family. And B, they might not even get tested. I've talked with, you know, counties to, you know, just today, in fact, I talked with counties that were saying that that's a problem they run into, that people will actually not want to get tested. They'll avoid getting tested, whether they're symptomatic or not, because, you know, what do you do if you test positive and you are the sole wage earner for your family and you have a big family? That's just, you'd almost rather be sick and deal with the consequences and hope that, you know, you're somebody that has mild illness and that, you know, it sticks that way and that nobody else in your family gets sick and you can't afford to lose those wages. So I think the idea is to help people out financially so they don't have to make those decisions.
And Peter, USCSD has started to aggressively test their students, their faculty and staff so that they could hope to reopen in-person classes in the fall. What do you make of that approach? And does it make sense this far out from the fall semester?
I think it makes the professors and administrators feel good, but it doesn't make sense in terms of the natural history of the virus because it's a snapshot in time. So unless you test with some regularity that you predefine, like, or periodicity, like every week, you know, when you test somebody a negative, it doesn't mean that the next hour they're not going to be exposed and then turn positive in the future. So that antecedent negative virus test doesn't really help me.
So you're thinking this is just some sort of feel-good
measure? I mean, it's nice that they can do it, but to rule it out on a scale of thousands has to be followed by some periodicity.
So let me stay with you about a couple of other things here, which is the drug development pipeline. And in this case, it's actually not development. It's just trying to see if drugs that are already existed.
Yeah, teaching an old drug new tricks.
Exactly. So remdesivir is showing some promise. There are some other drugs that are being considered. And then, of course, there's the WHO, which basically took the hydroxychloroquine arm out of its trial based on a report in a medical journal last week. What do you make of all that, especially with our president touting the virtues of that drug?
Yeah, so let's start with the... So I think about drugs for COVID as the Olympics. I might have mentioned that before. There's no gold medalist. The silver medalist is remdesivir, which again is no magic bullet, but it's an antivirus drug for virus. Go figure, you know, we're excited about that. And it does have modest effect in clinical trials, as people know might have read about, with a pretty good safety profile. Then there is kind of like a bronze medalist, which I think is convalescent plasma. It's a gift that keeps on giving because somebody who survived would develop these antibodies. You can infuse them into sick people. We just need to study it a little bit more and maybe elevate it up the medal rankings. And then there are the non-finishers. And I'll think about hydroxychloroquine in that category. In fact, hydroxychloroquine was disqualified from the race altogether because it has all of these toxic side effects, cardiac arrhythmias, QT prolongation. And that's for treatment. For prophylaxis, we're still waiting on some data, but the best data so far comes from rheumatoid arthritis and lupus patients that were on hydroxychloroquine, and those that got COVID didn't seem to do any better or didn't prevent them from getting COVID compared to those who when taking hydroxychloroquine.
And any updates on the vaccine front this week?
Oh, the vaccine front has been super active. I think there was a lot of news from Boston with Moderna. That was an RNA vaccine. But they didn't study folks who were under 55 years old. I guess they consider 55 and older old now, which is kind of scary for me. Then the next vaccine that's a little bit exciting is the Oxford group. They're going to study like 10,000 patients in the next arm. So I think people are excited about that. That's in combination with AstraZeneca. And there's a Pfizer-German combination. So what you see is basically a combination with like a lab and pharma, because pharma is the only people who can really push and get the vaccine in large enough quantities so that if it's promising, it'd be used by large numbers of people.
And Aaron, bringing it back locally, the San Francisco Department of Health reported an increase in the number of homeless individuals who died between March 30th and May 10th when compared to last year, 36 in this year's period compared to 12 in the same period last year. What are officials attributing these deaths to?
I believe most of those, or a good number of them, are tied to overdoses. So we're seeing, you know, this is a longstanding problem in the Bay Area and in San Francisco in particular, and it's been getting worse. We've reported about that a lot in recent years, between, you know, the fentanyl coming on scene and then meth combining with fentanyl. So there's just been a lot of big problems on the drug scene. And I think what we're seeing now is what happens with, you know, all of our public health, all of our resources diverted to this pandemic. And I think we're seeing some things kind of slipping through the cracks. And, you know, a lot of the resources that we would usually have to kind of focus in on these problems, these street problems, are, you know, we're just not kind of paying as close attention to them as we would is the thinking about what's going on. And then there have been other deaths that aren't overdoses, but, you know, are similarly people just, you know, the same thing we're seeing with other people, with other groups, where they're not seeking care. They're just, you know, not being kind of pursued through public health as aggressively as maybe they ordinarily would. So it's terrible, but not too surprising that that's something that we're seeing now.
So not COVID-related deaths as far as people in the city government are saying?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that that's what these numbers were looking at. That wasn't, I'm sure there have been some of those, but that's not what they were seeing in this particular report.
So as we wrap up this segment, I want to turn to each of you and ask you, what do you see coming up in the week ahead, or what stories are you hoping to see developments in? Let's start with you, Peter.
So I think in the next week, what we're going to see is some more trepidation about whether or not we'll be seeing an influx of cases into the hospital system. I think we've all been a little bit nervous about Memorial Day and like seeing like large numbers of people together, even in the Bay Area. So I think we're just a little bit nervous, but I remain hopeful, because always I'm a glass half full kind of guy, as you know.
And Aaron?
I agree with Peter. I think that's going to be certainly what I'm focused on over the next week or two, is what happens, like he said, with the Memorial Day festivities, but also, you know, now more, I mean, I think it's 40 some counties are in this early reopening path, or this more aggressive path. So I'll be very curious to see how that plays out in those counties over the next week or two.
Well, we'll turn to you again next Wednesday, Aaron Alday of the San Francisco Chronicle and Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF, to help us make sense of it all and work through the many more questions, I imagine, that will be in play next week. So thanks again for giving us your time each week, and talk to you again next week.
Thank you. And thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Aaron. Always a pleasure, Pache.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache. We're now joined by C. Pam Zhang. She's a Bay Area resident and author of the debut novel, How Much of These Hills is Gold? An epic story which follows two Chinese-American siblings as they try to survive on their own in the hills of California after the death of their father. Although her book takes place during the California Gold Rush, the book is not your typical Western. Her novel not only challenges the historically white male narrative of the American West, but also addresses modern themes such as sexuality, gender, and power, as well as immigration and belonging. So I welcome C. Pam Zhang to City Visions.
Thank you so much for having me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll take your calls at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you'd like to ask questions of our author, or you can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So Pam, what inspired you to write this book about an Asian family in the American West, a very different approach, as I mentioned in the intro, from the usual stories we hear?
So I grew up reading all these American Westerns, books like Little House on the Prairie, books like John Steinbeck's novels, books like Mary McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, and I really loved them. There's something about these books that set very small, mundane human families up against this epic backdrop, this really wild and gorgeous land that I just found really inspiring. And eventually, as I grew older, I realized that I never saw anybody like myself or my family reflected in them. I remember actually fantasizing when I was little about showing up one day in Laura Ingalls Wilder's sort of landscape and realizing her family would have no idea what to do with me. So I wanted to write an epic for some of the rest of us.
And in fact, your novel in some reviews has been compared to Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath and novels by Faulkner. Tell us how you chose to bring your need and desire to put a new face or add additional faces to the narrative with these types of books that were part of your childhood.
Yeah, so for me, the genesis of this book was really during a year in which I was actually living out of the country. I have sort of like lived in and out of the Bay Area starting from my adolescence, and it's definitely a place that I'm connected to, sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad ways. I have a very fraught relationship with it, but the way I speak of it sometimes is that as I was living thousands and thousands of miles away, it felt like the land was beginning to haunt me. Like, as much as I struggled sometimes with calling myself a resident of this part of the world, it had its hooks in me, so to speak. And so it was really at first a subconscious impulse. I just woke up one day with these opening images of two children on the run and this dry heat and these golden hills. And I just started writing.
Well, why don't you give us a sample of that writing and perhaps set up the passage that you're going to read for us?
Yeah. So I'm going to read from about halfway in the book. And this is a segment where Lucy, who is one of the two children, who is the protagonist of the book, is prospecting for gold with her father. And the book takes place in the gold rush. So the like dream of gold is a huge theme in the novel. Because this land they live in is a land of missing things, a land stripped of its gold, its rivers, its buffalo, its Indians, its tigers, its jackals, its birds, and its green, and its living. To move through this land and believe Ba's tales is to see each hill as a burial mound with its own crown of bones. Who could believe that and survive? Who could believe that and keep from looking, as Ba and Sam do, always toward the past? Letting it drag behind them, letting it make them into fools. And so Lucy fears that unwritten history, easier to dismiss all Ba's tales as tall ones, because believe in where does it end? If she believes that tigers live, then does she believe in it that Indians are hunted and dying? If she believes in fish the size of men, does she believe in men who string up others like linefuls of catch? Easier to avoid that history unwritten as it is, except in the soughing of dry grass and the marks of lost trails and the rumors from the mouths of bored men and mean girls and the cracked patterns of buffalo bone. And I'll stop there.
Quite a vivid and chilling piece of the book there. I was struck as I was hearing you read it just now. What was the journey like for you reading those novels that you alluded to in the beginning, the Western novels that you alluded to the beginning, and the history that perhaps you learned later in your years about how the West was won, so to speak, and trying to understand, the fairy tale versus the reality?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting about that is sometimes what I encountered in history books, especially growing up as a young child, was closer to the fairy tale than to some of the reality. What I mean by this is, you know, Laura Ingalls Wilder's books, for example, which were very formative for me, were supposedly based very closely on her life. But there's this amazing biography of her that came out, I think 2 years ago, and won the Pulitzer Prize, called Prairie Fires, that sort of shatters that myth and talks about how Laura's books are as much mythology as they are fact, predicated as they are upon this idea of like rugged individualism and people striking it out on their own, which just didn't make any financial sense for her family, which actually struggled to make ends meet her entire life. So I think the history books, this idea of like manifest destiny, this grand vision of Americans pushing ever west, those are also in the vein of mythology. And so for me, it was a journey much later in life to understand that history books are deeply political, and they have largely been written by white men, and they exclude so many aspects of history. For example, the history of immigrants, of Native people, of Chinese Americans.
So what myths about the West were you hoping to rebalance or perhaps contest by centering your story on an Asian family?
I mean, in some sense, it's a very simple answer. It's simply that we existed and we had adventures and we lived epic lives. We weren't constrained to sort of like this bit piece in somebody else's story, or it was just really that we exist and can be very diverse and complex and conflicted in our lives.
The epigraph at the start of your book reads, "This land is not your land." What were you thinking when you chose that? And how does that fit in with what you just said about the existence or non-existence, depending on the lens through which one sees the history of the West and the Asian populations that helped settle it?
Oh man. So that epigraph came very late into the writing process, actually. I had written entire drafts of the novel end to end before I came up with it. And it was, to me, a little bit like a stake in the ground for the reader. I wanted it to be a little bit defiant. This land is not your land is an allusion to the fact that the characters of this book never feel like the land is wholly their land. It's also a warning to the reader that the land you're reading about is contested land that you should feel sort of uncomfortable with too. And then finally, it's sort of a reminder that my book, though it is labeled as historical fiction, is a reimagined history. It has elements of the surreal. And so you should be careful where you tread.
So you mentioned gold is a big part of your book. There's also references to tigers, claws, drawings appearing throughout the book. Of course, tigers are not native to California. Why did you choose to make them a part of this telling of the story of the American West during the Gold Rush?
Yeah, tigers are not in the West, for anyone who's confused. I think I have confused some people now. I wanted to, again, bring in this element of the surreal, this sort of signal to the reader that things are not quite what they seem. And also a big part of this book was sort of not just reimagining mythology of the West, but sort of owning it a little bit through the particular lens through which my family lived. So tigers are a big part of Chinese mythology, as far as I understand, and I actually know very little about it, but it was a way to infuse a little bit of that Chinese-American culture into the landscape.
We're talking with C. Pam Zong. She is the author of How Much Gold Is in These Hills, a new novel that she debuted with just last month. And we welcome you, our listeners, to call in to discuss this this novel and the idea of the American West with our novelist and guest tonight. The number to dial is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So going back, Pam, to things not appearing as they are, let's talk about the two characters, Lucy and Sam, the siblings. Tell us, there's a lot of question around their gender and how they relate to each other because of the roles they play, the gendered roles they play. Tell us about them, you mentioned how they came into your imagination, but then tell us how you created that relationship between them and the issue of gender between them.
Yeah, I think those two questions are very much related. So I've always been interested in this idea of the outsider's gaze upon someone. Can someone looking in from the outside ever understand a person for who they are? And I think that question is even more fraught when you're talking about siblings who have this sort of unfortunate, perhaps, situation of growing up together and therefore being compared to one another all the time. So if identity is already a sort of like murky and difficult thing as you're a child to figure out, it becomes even murkier when you have this other person that people are comparing you to, right? So one of these two siblings, Sam, is what we would probably today call either transgender or gender nonconforming, born female and who chooses to present as a boy. And that question of being seen is something that these two children are hyper aware of as the only Chinese Americans in their society. And for Sam, as somebody who really learns to control their outward appearance, to sort of be seen and understood for the way they feel they internally are.
Was this something that you were thinking of when you're thinking of today's awareness and appreciation of the transgender community and its struggles? Or were you thinking about it in terms of what was going on at that time, and particularly in Chinese culture, where sons are prized over daughters?
I don't think anyone's actually picked up on that last part yet. I do think that the aspect of sons traditionally being prized over daughters had a big impact on my writing, Sam. But honestly, if I dig back into it, you know, so much of writing is by instinct at first blush. And so I didn't set out to sort of like achieve any motive or to have representation in my book in that sense with a capital R. But I have, for many years working as a woman in the San Francisco tech scene, just been really fascinated by seeing gender roles play out and how there are power differentials across genders and how women have always had to be hyper careful about the way they look and what that says about them and about their capabilities.
And the dynamic between the siblings is also quite interesting. Lucy takes kind of a backseat in some ways, although she's caring for her younger sibling. And yet the story is told mostly from her point of view. How did you arrive at that?
Yeah, I think for me, Lucy was the ultimate observer because she, out of the two siblings, is the one who's always been more interested in assimilating into the culture in which they live in. So therefore sort of like shrinking herself down small, twisting herself to be what other people want her to be. And I don't really know how it came out this way, but she ended up being the way that we saw the book. And I think because of her relative sort of like quiet, she has a sharper gaze of the world on the world than Sam does.
And without giving away the end of the story, she makes a very pivotal decision that sacrificial decision at the end of the book that really speaks to a sense of duty to and almost sort of deference to a younger brother.
Yes, she does.
So another part of the book is the relationship between the mother and the father, Ma and Ba, who Ma is actually a Chinese immigrant and Ba is of Chinese heritage, but born in the United States. Tell us about how you envisioned their relationship.
Yeah, I think in that way, I was actually interested in interrogating the cultural divide that can exist between two people who, right, outwardly look like they come from the same culture and are assumed by all others around them to share that culture. But there are many tensions between and many differences between being Chinese in the way that Ba is and in the way that Ma is and Chinese American in the way Ba is. And I was really interested in those tensions that arose out of their differences and out of their sort of assumed similarities that later kind of caused fractures in their relationship.
And speaking of how they are perceived by those around them, the family struggles because they are different, as they're the only ones around, as you mentioned earlier. And they suffer quite a bit because of this. And this kind of sets the whole stage for how the story evolves and what happens to the family over time. And so you point very specifically to bias against this Asian family. I'm curious now in this current epidemic pandemic that we're living through, there's been a lot of anti-Asian bias expressed in this country. How do you kind of put those two things together? What do you see as the arc of time between the gold rush and today?
You know, in some ways, it's not very different. As I said, I worked and still work in San Francisco Tech, and I see that as our modern gold rush in a way. And I think this American idea of being able to, right, find your fortune, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that hasn't actually changed as like the foundation of our ideals from the 1800s up till now. And what's kind of eerie is I started writing this novel in early 2015, long before the pandemic, long before our current president's election into office. And I remember wondering if what I had written about this sort of naked racism and violence against Asian Americans would be seen as too maudlin, too extreme. And I think it just goes back to growing up Asian American, you're often sort of like questioning your own views of the world. You're questioning whether the bigotry and racism you're seeing is real or in your mind. And this was kind of an ugly affirmation of that. It's always been here and it's just now erupting in more visible ways.
In a way, it doesn't get as much airtime, so to speak, not to compare the struggles of different groups of color, but just that it's something that doesn't always occur to people that there is anti-Asian bias.
Yes, yes. It is also important to point out, though, that in often cases, because of this model minority myth that has been perpetuated upon and also by Asian Americans, it's true that the ways we experience bias are often less punishing, I suppose, in terms of actual violence and deaths. And something that I was really interested in interrogating in this novel that is also very relevant these days is this question of how when Asian Americans absorb the model minority myth and ally themselves with white society, how much harm can they perpetuate against other people of color?
Interesting. Quite an unusual take on that. Yeah.
I mean, yes and no. I don't know if you've been following the George Floyd news. There was, yes, in that case, an Asian American, I believe, cop who was complicit because he was at the scene of the crime. And in my communities, there's been a lot of talk about that, about how as Asian Americans, we can combat sort of anti-Blackness and colorism in our own communities.
What do you see as a path forward?
Well, I think for one, there is a lot of education to be done. And in the same way that I've seen a lot of the Asian community call upon white people in this time and age to sort of like speak to their own family members who have problematic views because they're the most likely to be heard, I think we need to do that same within our own communities. Like if you have a mother or an aunt who makes casually racist remarks, don't just humor them. Don't just let it slide. Like really call it out, send them reading material, educate them, do that work yourselves. And I do think that there is also a need from Asian Americans to actively reach across that divide and think about how we can help Black communities and support them.
This reminds me of a show we did a few months back where we had some activists and artists that were putting films together about the Japanese American internment. Although the inspiration for their work was very personal in some ways, depending on who we were talking to, that there was also this sense of, at the time that we spoke to them, rising up in defense of immigrants who were being mistreated at the border. So this ties in quite nicely with that.
Mm-hmm. It certainly does. There are all sorts of interconnected issues happening right now.
So this is a family that is disrupted, that we've alluded to. The mother is really not in the story. And then the children, the book opens with the children seeking to bury their recently deceased father. Quite a shocking way to just thrust two preteens in that time into a situation like that. Of all the strife that a family could have endured, why this one? Why such a decimated family?
That's a really great question. I think that for me, I've written a lot of speculative fiction. And so I'm always interested from a craft perspective in how fiction can sort of like take the extremes of experience, sort of ask the ultimate what if, not only like what if, like how sad are you when a parent dies, but like how sad are you when a parent dies, it's your last parent in the world and you are literally alone with nobody else to sort of help you shape your sense of identity and history and culture. And so that was one way of interrogating that extreme. Also, my own father passed away very suddenly when I was in my early 20s. And in a way, I don't like it when others call writing fiction therapy, but in a way, this was a way of working through that for myself and just coming to terms with looking at that event, looking at it, perhaps you could say from a slant, because it is obviously not an autobiographical novel.
Well, it fits with the passage that you read to us, the harshness of the land. And then you chose one of the most extreme and harshest conditions to put the protagonists in this story. Tell us how the father plays a role in this book, even though he's dead at the beginning of the story.
Yeah, so to return a little bit to that epigraph that you read out. Oh, sorry, not to the epigraph. So the book has a dedication, and I'll actually read it for just a moment. The dedication is to my father, Zhang Hongjian, loved but slenderly known. That phrase, slenderly known, is one that I took from Shakespeare's King Lear. And it's because I'm really fascinated by this sort of unanswerable question of how can parents ever fully know their children and how can children ever fully know their parents? Certainly that generation gap is very hard to cross because you see your parent at such a different stage of life. You've never seen them for the person they were before you were born. And in the case of this family, it's even more pronounced because it is also across this cultural gap where the parents cannot and will not speak of the lives they lived before their children were born. So that was really my way of, I think it's a question that a lot of immigrant children, children of immigrants, face. And this book was another way of looking at that question as well.
And you, in fact, repeat this question of what makes a family. So how would you answer that?
Oh, yeah, that's probably the hardest question I've yet to receive in this book promotion. I don't know. It's really hard to answer. It sounds so cheesy, but I think my current answer is your family is the people that you are comfortable with, the people that support you, but also that you can be in some ways your worst self around, because the strange and almost magical bonds of family are such that you can hurt your family members. You can say the most awful things to them, but in most cases, they will still stay with you. There is something about that where, like, a deep and fundamental level of trust that I think is hard to find in other relationships.
And you also talk about what makes a home, and you've come back to the Bay Area. You said it had its hooks in you, I believe, earlier on in our conversation when you were living abroad. What do you make of the Bay Area today and your life in it?
I'm always so conflicted about it. You know, I have one foot, as I've said, in the world of tech, and I am myself extremely privileged to have a job, have a partner who has a job, to be able to afford to live here without great hardship. So I have people I know who are in that sphere of things, in the sphere of affluence in the Bay Area. And then I have friends who are artists and struggling. And I don't know what to make of that. It is a place of such great contradictions. It's honestly a very confusing place to live in. And I've thought many times about whether this is the place I'll end up. But for right now, I think that as long as I'm here and we're all here, we have to try to make a path forward that works for all of us. So I don't really have a great answer to that.
And so how's promoting a book during this period working for you?
Mostly it's kind of a surreal experience, because my book came out at the beginning of April after we all sheltered in place in the Bay Area. I have yet to see it in a bookstore. So it doesn't even feel real to me yet. You know, I've been writing it for so many years. And even the way the book world works, the authors get to see sort of like a printed bound version of the book like 6 months before the book goes to print. So there was, to me, no sort of crossing of a finish line. There's no event I can point to where I was like, yes, that feels like my book is real now.
And so are you doing like virtual book tours and readings at this point, or is any of that planned?
Yes, I've probably done about 14 virtual events at this point, all from one lovely corner of my couch. And, you know, I will say it's actually been more wonderful than I anticipated. There's something really lovely about friends from sort of like all over the world being able to dial in, and people have sent me pictures of them cooking dinner or like, you know, petting their pets or out in their garden drinking cocktails or doing whatever while attending the event, which I think is actually a plus of this. And I mean, overall, the independent bookstores have been doing such a wonderful job of supporting authors, even as they're going through this time of extreme crisis themselves. So while I have the chance on the radio waves, I would really encourage everyone listening to go out and buy books from your local independent bookstores, because they are really wonderful supporters of diversity in literature. They're there for you to give personal recommendations in a way that Amazon never, ever can or will. So yeah, bookshop.org is a really great site. And in the Bay Area, I love Green Apple Books and Booksmith on Haight Street.
Wonderful. And if people want to learn more about you and about your writing, how can they find you?
Oh, I'm on all the usual social medias. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram, and there's a sort of like email form on my site if anyone wants to write in and say anything or ask questions, but great. I'm virtually all around.
Okay. Well, we'll make sure to put one of those links on our website. So I want to thank you so much, C. Pam Zhang, for joining me this evening. She's the author of a debut novel, How Much of These Hills is Gold. Good luck to you in the promoting of your book, and thanks for taking the time to speak with me tonight.
Thank you so much, Joseph.
chance to start.
And welcome back to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache. And as we've done for the last several weeks, we're ending our program tonight with a segment highlighting Bay Area arts and artists during this COVID pandemic. And tonight we're joined by Chris Verdugo, the executive director of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Welcome, Chris.
Hey there, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. So how is the chorus holding up?
You know, we're holding up. I'd love to say we're doing great, but we're not. These have been difficult times. They've been difficult times for all of us. I would say that, you know, we're certainly finding harmony and companionship and brotherhood where we can, you know, and certainly every Monday night through the through Zoom. So we have, you know, we have learned how to work Zoom to our advantage.
Wow, you must have like a mega Zoom account.
You have no idea.
Yeah, how big is the chorus?
The 300 singing members.
Wow.
And how? And then we have alumni. That, okay. So the numbers can go up to, you know, if you start counting alumni and singers who are on leave. I mean, we're all sort of on leave at the moment, right? It can go up to the 600-700.
Hmm. And so what did the group decide to do to make this a more tolerable period of isolation and still stay connected with their fans and the community?
Thanks for asking that, Joseph. So when we started to shelter in place, we followed the city and the mayor lockstep. And as soon as that announcement was made, we closed down the organization, basically, in the sense that we canceled all rehearsals, canceled all performances in our brand new LGBTQ Center for the Arts, and we canceled our upcoming performances. And that was a really massive hit to our LGBTQ community, especially our supporters and our supporters, our donors, to our singers. And so out of necessity was born this idea of how do we stay connected to our community? And not only how do we stay connected, but how do we fulfill our mission and how do we continue to be compassionate and empathetic and really uplift and inspire? And I don't know which came first. It's a chicken or an egg situation, because the idea of the truly brave video and the concept of the platform SFGMC-TV. Sort of, I really don't know how that happened, which one was first, but what I know is that we decided to create this platform, SFGMC-TV, wherein we could host a concert footage, interviews with some of our friends, the likes of Billy Porter, Kristen Chenoweth, Adam Rippon, and also sort of a spotlight into our singers. And then, you know, we knew that we wanted to launch it with something that was truly meaningful and a message to really the world and especially to first responders. And that's how the idea of Truly Brave, the virtual choir of Truly Brave, came to be. We love the fact that it has maybe close to 300,000 views. What's more important to us are the views that it's had by first responders and the messages back that we've heard from across the world, you know, from nurses and doctors just saying, we just watched your video, you know, you didn't know how much we needed to see this tonight before our shift. And that's what's really been inspiring for us.
So tell us a little bit about Truly Brave. It's a mashup of two songs, right?
It's a mashup of True Colors by Cyndi Lauper and Brave by Sarah Bareilles. And they first performed it, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago at an event. And so it's been one of our staple songs. And as we looked through the repertoire, we knew that that was the message that we wanted to send. And then we created, you know, virtual choirs are not an easy thing.
I was wondering about that.
They're not mixing the audio, all of those videos. It is not an easy endeavor. And I have to give credit to Paul Ciccone, one of our board members and a video editor, just so much more than that, but an incredible man who spent, I think he thought it would take, you know, 2-3 days, and it was about 10 days later that he was able to finish the product. But he finished a beautiful product. We were all so thrilled with this, you know, the final video and the message with it.
And just to our listeners, stay tuned, because we're going to be closing out our show with Truly Brave. So don't go away as the credits roll, so to speak. So tell us a little bit more about the history of the organization and how it sees itself in the history of San Francisco today and in other times of crisis.
Sure. Thanks for asking that. You know, the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus is the largest and oldest LGBTQ chorus in the world. We're considered the granddaddies of the LGBTQ choral movement, one that spans five continents and hundreds of choruses around the world. We were born out of adversity. Our first public performance was on the steps of City Hall the night that Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone were assassinated. I feel like the idea of adversity and struggle has it's in our DNA. So we always know when we're presented with this situation, there's just sort of this inherent, this inherent knowingness that the organization has. And we went through this, you know, through the AIDS crisis, through most of the 80s into the early 90s. And the chorus has been, you know, really a beacon for the LGBTQ community here in San Francisco. In 1990, we hosted an event on Christmas Eve at the Castro Theater called Home for the Holidays. And it was for all of our brothers and sisters who didn't have a place to go for the holidays, whose families weren't, didn't want them to come home because they were HIV positive or had AIDS, or just because they were gay. And we created this space to come together, you know, one Christmas Eve, free of charge. And what, you know, what became that one, you know, that one night of just, I think, sheer generosity and compassion turned into a 30-year affair, you know, where every Christmas Eve there's, you know, 5,000 people who come to the Castro Theater. But the origins of that, we're really, we're really just, the chorus wanted to be there for the community. I think that's what, you know, that's what has motivated us now and what has motivated us to create this platform, so that during these times, you know, anyone can just kind of plug into our website, plug into the platform and listen to music, be uplifted by some of the funniest performances we've ever done, but also, you know, touched and inspired, you know, by the beautiful music that the chorus creates.
Well, let's listen to that. So before we turn it over to the music, I just want to thank you, Chris Verdugo and the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, for what you're doing to support San Francisco and others around the world to feel supported during this difficult time.
Thank you, Joseph.
And I also want to thank my previous guests, Aaron Alday, Dr. Peter Chin Hong, and C. Pam Zong for this show. I want to thank David LaTulipe, who was our engineer, who continues to amaze me with his ability to do all this juggling, and to two wonderful producers, Chris Newney and Kendra Klang, who helped put together tonight's show. And we hope you will listen next week when my co-host Grace Wan will be here for the latest coronavirus updates and a conversation with David Plouffe about his new book, The Citizen's Guide to Defeating Truff. And right now, we'll listen to the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus and Truly Brave.
World's for the people. You can lose sight of it. All the darkness inside you makes you feel so small.
You can be amazing. You can turn a phrase into a weapon or a drug. You could be the outcast or be the backlash of somebody's lack of love. But I wonder what could happen.